From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, after a bruising week for the NSA's government surveillance programmes, a presidential panel puts forward nearly 50 recommendations for future surveillance powers.
Well, at least getting it out of the government's hands is a good start. The problem when you give it to the private sector, though, is that it's unaccountable. There's absolutely no accountability at all.
Two men are found guilty of the brutal murder of a British soldier on a London street in May. We hear from a Zimbabwean author protesting against the government's indigenization law. And in a surprise move, Russian President Vladimir Putin says he'll pardon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, a man many view as a political prisoner.
He's been in jail for 10 years now, which is a pretty substantial period under any circumstances.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster.
At least five people have been seriously injured and at least 65 others affected after a balcony collapsed in a London theater, trapping audience members in the middle of a performance. Due to rescue efforts, everyone has now been freed at Apollo Theater in London's West End. A performance of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime was underway at the theater, which was built in 1901. Audience member Ian Creasy described what happened on London's LBC radio.
What we saw first and foremost was people right at the top of the theatre shouting and moving to the left and the right of the theatre to try and get away from the centre. And the next thing is there was a scream from somebody shouting, "Get out!" And at that point, the roof, or at least the plasterwork of the roof, fell straight down, right down through all of the circles onto the stalls, followed by a pretty significant amount of really thick, dense black dust. People then started getting out through the exits as quickly as they could.
President Obama has announced his latest round of presidential pardons, commuting the prison sentences of eight individuals serving time for crack cocaine convictions. It's part of an effort to address the disparity between the punishments handed down for crack and powdered cocaine offenses. Malcolm Brown reports.
The eight men and women who had their terms commuted were all sent to prison before passage of legislation designed to reduce the disparity between penalties for crack and powdered cocaine. The group, all of whom have served more than 15 years, are among the thousands of inmates for whom the Fair Sentencing Act came too late, the White House says. In a statement, President Obama called his clemency decision an important step toward restoring fundamental ideals of justice and fairness. He also called on Congress to pass sentencing reform next year.
An independent panel sponsored by the White House is recommending limits on what data the U.S. National Security Agency and other intelligence groups can gather about American citizens. The panel started its work after documents revealed by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden revealed the agency was collecting billions of records without a court order. With one U.S. federal judge ruling that the policies violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of no unreasonable search and seizure. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
Just because we can do it does not mean we should do it. That was the essential finding of an independent panel on the NSA's data collection methods. The commission recommends a series of changes, from creating separate leadership posts at the National Security Agency and the Pentagon's U.S. Cyber Command, to stopping the NSA from collecting all metadata, that is the time and phone numbers for telephone calls, and instead having telecommunications firms or a private consortium store that information until a court order is presented. Campaigners welcome the tough report, but wondered if President Obama will have the political strength to actually carry out the reforms.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russian President Vladimir Putin said he will pardon former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky in the near future. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, once Russia's richest man, was arrested in 2003 and has remained in prison since, sparking worldwide concern that his trial was politically motivated. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
Quite a surprising and to Vladimir Putin's press conference minutes after the event was over, Vladimir Putin said he will pardon jailed businessman Mikhail Khodorkovsky after he has spent more than a decade in prison. He said that Khodorkovsky submitted an appeal for pardon and that he intends to grant it. The news of Mikhail Khodorkovsky's release come as Russian State Duma passed an amnesty bill on Wednesday.
The lawyer for an Indian diplomat whose arrest in New York has sparked a deepening diplomatic row has accused U.S. authorities of deliberately mishandling her arrest. Devani Koprakati, India's deputy consul general in New York, was arrested and strip-searched last week on visa fraud charges related to her housekeeper. Nina Maria Potts reports.
In an interview with CNN, Dan Arshak, the lawyer for Devani Koprakati, accused U.S. authorities of trying to humiliate his client and flex their muscles. His comments come a day after the prosecutor in the case, Manhattan U.S. attorney Preet Bharara, hit back at accusations there's nothing to the case against India's deputy consul general in New York. In a statement, the prosecutor said the sole motivation in this case, as in all cases, is to uphold the rule of law and protect victims. The case has sparked international outrage over the fact the Indian diplomat was strip-searched over her alleged mistreatment of her housekeeper. Relations between the U.S. and India are now in dire straits.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. It's been a rough week for the NSA's government surveillance programs. First, a federal judge deemed the bulk collection of domestic phone records Orwellian and likely unconstitutional. Then a group of CEOs from Yahoo, Google and other major tech companies met with the president at the White House and told him government monitoring of personal communications is hurting their businesses. And now a presidential panel has put forward nearly 50 recommendations for curtailing the government's many surveillance powers, making the process less secretive and allowing employees like Edward Snowden more opportunity to blow the whistle on official misconduct. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein has more.
Government should stop the mass collection and storage of domestic phone records. The NSA should be a civilian agency separate from the military, and they should disclose more information to Congress and the American people. These are just some of the 46 proposals from the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technologies published this week. For Capitol Hill's privacy advocates, such as Oregon Democrat and longtime surveillance critic Ron Wyden, the report was a vindication of the reforms he and some colleagues have been demanding for years.
When you look at what they recommended in terms of saying that bulk phone record collection, all these records of millions of people, was not indispensable in terms of preventing attacks, that there are alternative methods, that and outlawing the backdoor search loophole and the FISA court recommendations. These are exactly the kind of proposals reformers have sought.
But many independent privacy advocates criticized the report for not going far enough. Constitutional attorney Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee said he was disappointed because instead of recommending the complete termination of the phone records program, the board recommended private corporations collect and store that data instead and then let the government search through it when needed.
Well, at least getting it out of the government's hands is a good start. The problem when you give it to the private sector, though, is that it's unaccountable. There's absolutely no accountability at all. There's no mechanism for control. There's even less transparency than with government, and there's no reason to think that the private sector will be any less susceptible to becoming abusive in this context.
The review panel's recommendations are just that. They're non-binding. White House spokesperson Jake Carney told reporters this week that the president will spend the next few weeks reading the more than 300-page report and will decide which points to adopt, which to reject, and which to study further. Buttar noted that President Obama has already rejected one of the report's recommendations to separate the NSA from the military's cyber command instead of having them both run by a single person.
And the concentration of power in military hands and the authority to tap the back end of the internet and phone system and also conduct cyber warfare basically means that the single branch of the military has the power to, for instance, pull the kill switch on the internet or use it as a tool to suppress any particular social movement. And the reason that power is divided in the United States was that divided power cannot as easily become oppressive.
At the president's request, the panel began reviewing the nation's surveillance programs in August, soon after former NSA contractor Edward Snowden began leaking documents about the programs that sparked protest in the U.S. and around the world. Though their report does not mention Snowden by name, Liz Goetin with the Brennan Center for Justice said it includes recommendations that would help people like him.
It talks about the need for a meaningful outlet for people within the intelligence community to raise concerns that might involve classified information. And so this is really significant. It's the first time that national security whistleblowers would have an outlet that actually takes them outside the intelligence community, a legal outlet.
Senator Ron Wyden said the release of the report gives great momentum to bills he and other lawmakers introduced this year to rein in and shine light on the NSA's sweeping powers, bills that so far have languished in committee. New York Democrat Chuck Schumer agreed, saying he expects to see a vote on some reform measures early next year. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports.
This country is not bad because the marshal now, he wants to change. And I'm there. He wants to change. If you meet the marshal over there, he's a very good guy. And that's very serious. He has to do his job, but he's a very good guy.
Dennis Rodman during his second visit to North Korea earlier this year. The former NBA star has just touched down in Pyongyang for a third time, just a week after the Korean media reported the execution of leader Kim Jong-un's uncle, a man considered the country's second most powerful figure. Rodman, who has in the past described North Korea's leader as a very good guy, is expected to spend 4 days in the country training local basketball players ahead of an exhibition game. Earlier, I discussed the unconventional relationship between Rodman and North Korea with FSN's Daniel Renches.
He is training the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea's basketball team, their national basketball team. So this is a bit more of the sports diplomacy that he's advocated doing with the North Koreans. Unlike some previous occasions, he's tried to sort of withdraw a little bit from this diplomatic role that he's sort of tried to play. But at the same time, he's still asking President Obama to give the DPRK, young DPRK leader Kim Jong-un, a call.
On previous visits that Dennis Rodman has taken to North Korea, the family of a detained Korean-American, Kenneth Bae, have called upon him to intervene and try and in some way facilitate the release of Mr. Bae. Will Rodman champion the cause on this visit to Pyongyang, or will he cut out any diplomatic role and keep it to business purely on the basketball court?
Initially, he said that he was trying to persuade the young leader to release Kenneth Bae and do him what he called a solid, which means a favour. But since then, he's apparently had no success and has indicated that he wants to withdraw from that mediating role with the relationship and that he's just there as a friend to Kim Jong-un and to help with the nation's basketball team. The mother of Kenneth Bae has actually appealed to him and said, look, we really need you to do this. But so far, we've had no indications that he's prepared to play that role.
Rodman describes Kim Jong-un as a good guy, but the young leader of North Korea has overseen a recent purge involving the execution of his uncle. This is still a fractious leadership. Is the presence of Dennis Rodman, considering that all of the cameras in North Korea will be pointed on him, there will be smiling faces and happy people and excellent publicity to be had here, is this a PR exercise North Korea can capitalise on?
I don't think anybody's fooled. I think most people see Dennis Rodman going there and they say to themselves, he kind of looks a bit out of his depth. He kind of looks a little bit foolish. I think that's a fair comment, to be honest, because clearly what's going on in North Korea at the moment is that there is a major power, a takeover of power by Kim Jong-un. a substantial takeover of power by taking out the second most powerful person in the country, his uncle. I think he's showing in very clear terms that he's prepared to do anything to hold on to power and to consolidate power. That being put aside, some people argue here in Washington that actually, where is DPRK policy in Washington? What's it doing? Is it just going to stand back and wait for something more to happen? Are they going to allow the South Koreans, for example, to take over the diplomacy? What are they going to do? Is the DPRK still developing nuclear weapons? Probably so. So what are the Americans doing? So some would argue at least Dennis Rodman is making an effort to engage in some way. So that's a reasonable argument as well. And I think, you know, it can't do any harm for him to engage in sports diplomacy. But the idea that somehow he could persuade the DPRK leader to change any of his policies is clearly not going to have any effect on a man who's prepared to kill his uncle.
FSN's Washington correspondent Daniel Renches. Two men have been found guilty of murdering a British soldier on a London street in May this year. Fusilier Lee Rigby was run over by a car and then hacked at with a meat cleaver by 29-year-old Michael Adebalajo and 22-year-old Michael Edebowale. Lee Rigby's family broke down in tears in court as the verdicts were read out. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Lee Rigby's family's reaction to the verdicts was delivered outside court on their behalf by Detective Inspector Pete Sparks.
We would like to thank everyone who has helped us to finally get justice for Lee and the overwhelming support that we have received. This has been the toughest time of our lives. No one should have to go through what we've been through as a family. We are satisfied that justice has been done, but unfortunately, no amount of justice will bring Lee back. These people have taken him away from us forever, but his memory lives on in all of us, and we will never forget him. We are very proud of Lee, who served his country, and we will now focus on building a future for his son, Jack, making him as proud of Lee as we all are.
Lee Rigby's family have been in regular attendance at the Old Bailey in London, but often left the courtroom as the jury was shown graphic pictures of the last moments of the soldier's life. He was run over in a car by Michael Adebalajo and Michael Adebowale, who then hacked at him with a knife and a meat cleaver before police arrived and shot them. These converts to Islam had been on the radar of security services, though. Michael Adebalajo was detained in Kenya in 2010 on suspicion of seeking to train with an Al-Qaeda-linked group in Somalia. He'd appeared in court there.
These people, they are mistreating us and we are innocent, believe me.
And that 2010 court appearance is among the things leaving Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner Cressida Dick admitting opportunities may have been missed.
There may well be, with the benefit of hindsight, things that not just the police, not just the agencies, I'm sure all sorts of people are scratching their heads and saying, how could I have stopped this? People in schools, in institutions, people in the family. So there may be something which, when we look back, looks like a missed opportunity to do more.
Both men had denied the charges, with Michael Adebalajo telling the court it was not murder because he was a soldier of Allah, describing the killing as a military operation. That was dismissed as a defence by the judge, and the prosecution told the court the two men set out to cause carnage. Prime Minister David Cameron says the extremist threat remains.
I think it also shows that we have to redouble our efforts to confront the poisonous narrative of extremism and violence that lay behind this and make sure that we do everything to beat it in our country.
Lee Rigby's brutal murder on a London street in broad daylight shocked the city and beyond. And so on the occasion of the guilty verdicts, Londoners have been calling local radio station LBC with their reactions.
I'm a Muslim and I'm a father of a six-month-old, and I was deeply saddened and upset at what happened to Lee Rigby. What this man did was totally un-Islamic. There's no Islamic value which even suggests that you can do something like that.
Universities are a key problem, not so much the mosque. Mosques do not allow this kind of thing. They chuck these people out. But at universities, when young, impressionable people go there and they met with these hotheads who go around accusing them of not being good Muslims, and they sort of like railroad them into this kind of extreme thinking.
Afghanistan veteran Lee Rigby was 25 when he was murdered by Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowale. They will be sentenced in January. Ollie Barrett, London.
President Vladimir Putin looks set to pardon oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky after a decade in jail in what many view as a political gesture ahead of next year's Winter Olympics in Russia. During an annual state TV address, Mr. Putin said he would soon free Khodorkovsky, already due for release in August, in a surprise move that even sparked a rise in Moscow share prices. Mikhail Khodorkovsky was imprisoned on fraud and tax evasion charges in 2003, but many Kremlin critics view him as a political prisoner, targeted for his opposition to Vladimir Putin's ruling party. Earlier, I discussed the case with Fiona Hill, senior fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institute.
Khodorkovsky is coming up towards the period where he would be due for release anyway. He's been in jail for 10 years now, which is a pretty substantial period under any circumstances. And it's not entirely clear from the various announcements that we've had as to whether this would be a complete pardon, some kind of clemency based on humanitarian grounds. You know, the Russian itself is somewhat ambiguous on this. Does it mean that there would be no basis for double jeopardy, you know, like in the United States or in other settings where he would be immune for further prosecution? Would there still be some kind of threat of future cases against him hanging over him? Would he be encouraged to leave Russia? Would he be allowed to stay? Basically, the announcement leaves open so many different questions, and obviously we'll be speculating about this for quite some time until things become clear. Also, the timing. Is this going to be before the Sochi Olympics, after the Sochi Olympics? Is it imminent? So we have a lot of things to ponder here.
Can you just give us some background on the case of Mikhail Khodorkovsky? I mean, this is a former tycoon. He spent the last 10 years in jail. And it's a story that is often partnered with the phrase politically motivated sentence.
Well, the Khodorkovsky case is really emblematic of the whole system that Putin has put in place since he became president first back in 1999-2000, so 13, 14 years ago. Khodorkovsky was, as you said, one of the tycoons, one of the so-called oligarchs, one of the first crop of really successful businessmen who emerged out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Khodorkovsky didn't have any particular connections to either the Yeltsin family or to Putin himself when he came in. And Khodorkovsky is always held up as someone who was trying to do something a little bit different. He was trying to break away from the mold of doing business in a sort of post-Soviet style, trying to move his company, Yukos, which was one of the largest oil companies, energy companies, in a more international direct. He was just on the verge of doing this, was even in talks with ExxonMobil at the time that he was arrested. And so he transformed himself from one of the robber barons, essentially, into a Western-style businessman. He hadn't completely undergone the transformation. There were still some questions about his previous business practices. But he was certainly being very much paid attention to inside and outside Russia. He'd become quite involved in politics, in sort of setting up think tanks and encouraging political participation by different groups initially under the encouragement of the Kremlin, but then it seemed much more independent in his case. There was a lot of speculation when he was arrested back in 2003 that this was because of his political activity, but frankly it might have had more to do with the fact that he was breaking the rules of doing business under the Putin system. He was trying to go it alone, not following the directives of the Kremlin. He was trying to take a huge, essentially Russian energy company private, international, which would have put it outside of the reach of directives from the Kremlin. And by many accounts, ever since Khodorkovsky went into jail, people have come to the conclusion that he's sitting there as a lesson to everyone else, to any other oligarch who might think that they can do business on their own terms and not with the strings attached from the Kremlin. And he's been made an example of over and over and over again.
And if Khodorkovsky, along with the Greenpeace activists, the Arctic Greenpeace activists, and indeed the last two remaining members of Pussy Riot, are released as part of this annual amnesty, does this suggest that there is a softening, perhaps, in terms of Vladimir Putin's rule in Russia?
I don't think so. I think that what you're seeing here is really the historic issue of the good Tsar. If you look back into Russian history, there was always the idea that people went to jail or were released at the Tsar's prerogative, and this seems to be just an extension of this. I mean, Putin himself has made no qualms about the references to his order and the Tsarist order. Many people have called Putin Tsar Vladimir, you know, with tongue in cheek, but with a deeper meaning and a nod to what's effectively a Russian presidency that's more like a barely contained constitutional monarchy. And this, again, I mean, we have presidential pardon systems in the United States and there's amnesties in other countries. But again, in each cases, this is really the prerogative of the top leader to make these decisions. And it doesn't necessarily preclude any of these people being prosecuted again for something else. There'll be a cloud over them because it really is at the goodwill of the person at the top.
Fiona Hill from Washington's Brookings Institute. Zimbabwean authorities have given foreign businesses in the country an ultimatum to sign over a controlling stake in their companies. The so-called indigenisation law is demanding that foreign businesses cede 51% control to black indigenous Zimbabweans. Senior officials have warned that owners of foreign firms operating in certain sectors in Zimbabwe after the beginning of January will be arrested if they fail to comply. Indigenisation of the economy was one of President Robert Mugabe's main campaign pillars in the March election. Critics say the move is in reaction to the influx of foreign traders, especially from China and Nigeria, who have been accused of undercutting local retailers. Earlier, I spoke to Kathy Buckle, a Zimbabwe-based author who said the legislation deadline has caused anxiety in the business community.
The Minister of Indigenisation has said that every company being run by non-black Zimbabweans must outline a plan and submit it by the 1st of January 2014 to show how they're going to give 51% of their shares to a black indigenous Zimbabwean. If you are a born Zimbabwean like I am, if you are not black, then you are not entitled to have a business. You have to give 51% of the shares of your business to a black Zimbabwean. So basically it means that non-black Zimbabweans cannot own businesses.
And do you fall into that bracket?
Well, I don't. I'm actually a dispossessed farmer, so I had my farm seized in 2000. Most of the country runs small businesses to survive because of this huge unemployment rate in the country. You know, there are no jobs.
So this indigenisation form, what will happen if people choose not to adhere to it?
Well, it has to be submitted by the 1st January 20. The Minister of Indigenisation has said that anybody who chooses not to submit it is liable to arrest and imprisonment.
And has there been an active protest movement against this?
There's no protest movement against it at all. There's just absolute panic because nobody knows what to do. But as it was with farms, you don't dare defy them because, you know, you will be arrested. So nobody knows what. So there's virtually nothing that you can do now unless you give 51% away.
People aren't willing to sacrifice or hand over the controlling stake of their companies. So what other action or course can they take?
Well, I mean, a couple of lawyers that we've spoken to have said the whole thing is unconstitutional and they're waiting for people to come forward so that they can challenge it in the Constitutional Court. At the moment, no one's come forward because no one really knows what to do and no one knows if it's actually going to happen, if it's going to be followed through or not. I mean, we can't believe that we will be forced to hand over 51% shares of private businesses.
Author Kathy Buckle in Zimbabwe. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, we follow the trials and tribulations of Washington's Immigrant Day labourers. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.